Let's get started if we could, please. Welcome, everyone. The time is now 8:32 on April 5th, 2019, and I call this meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. Could we have a roll call, please, Ms. Falks?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Bohansky?
Present.
Dr. Flowers?
Present.
Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Brundage? Dr. Davey?
Present.
Mr. Donaldson?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Dr. Malott? Ms. Shreve?
Present.
You have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Please note that the time stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend discussion on one agenda item, proceed to a timed item, and then return to the former agenda item at a later time. Licensees who attend board meetings may receive continuing education credit for their attendance. Credit may be used to fulfill the ethics requirement upon licensing renewal. For psychologists who wish to receive CE credit for attending this meeting, forms are available at the table at the rear or from a board staff member. In order to receive credit, please register on the CE roster, complete the three-page CE record form, have a one-page, the first page stamped and initialed by a board staff member, and keep that page for your records. Give the other two pages summarizing the meeting to the board staff. Please remember that you must stay until the end of the morning session or the afternoon session to earn three credits, and you must stay for the entire morning and afternoon session to earn six credits. The board encourages everyone in attendance today to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. Please place completed survey forms in the survey box located at the table at the rear of the room. I want to recognize all board members for your hard work over this past month. Each board member spends many hours in preparation for each meeting. We greatly appreciate your time and effort, especially dealing with our new internet system and logon silliness to try to get to the thousands of pages that we have to read each month. I would certainly also like to acknowledge the efforts of our board staff in helping us with all the hard work that they have done. And a special thanks, oh, this one's a hard one, to Heather Broadus for multiple years of dedicated service to this board. And congratulations on accepting the executive directorship of the podiatry board. She's gone from head to toe now.
All right, big clap for her. Woo!
And despite the fact that she's now a foot person, she has graciously agreed to assist us with our meeting here today. We are going to miss your hard work, dedicated service, and time. Gosh, over that, at least the 10 years I've been here, I appreciate everything you've done. I know I'll speak for the whole board in saying thank you, and best of luck with the foot folks. All right, we're going to move on to agenda item number 4, which is a call to the public. Ms. Falkers, is there anyone who's requested to speak?
Not that I'm aware of.
We have no requests. Those wishing to address the board don't need to request permission in advance. However, the board may limit those people speaking during this time to a reasonable number of any public comment. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given a few minutes to do so pursuant to ARS 38431.02H. The board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. Please complete a call to the public request to speak form and give it to the board staff should you want to be talking up here. Taking agenda item number 5, we have a council update. Ms. Kahn, would you provide an update for us, please?
Ms. Galvin will provide an update at your next board meeting.
Ah, thank you. That was short and sweet. I love it. Agenda item number 6 is our consent agenda. A member of the board may remove an item from the consent agenda. Are there any requests from any board members to remove any items?
Mr. Chair, I do not have a request, but I am recused from two applications, and I just want to let you know that that is for Rebecca Wright and Leslie Dorentes Barajas.
Thank you very much. Is there any other request to remove any items? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
I motion to approve the consent agenda.
Is there a second?
I second.
We have a motion and a second to approve consent agenda. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion carries. The consent agenda is approved. Thank you very much. We're doing this efficiently, so we have a few minutes before our next timed item, so I'm going to try to knock off some of the non-timed item issues. Can we start right at the top of the list, number 11?
Ms. Jones.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, board members, Dr. Sauls has requested to renew his license. In March, we received his application for renewal, and the staff noticed that he answered yes to question 10, which asks whether a licensee has been under investigation. He responded in the affirmative and indicated that he was under investigation for a couple matters in California, and we are asking for direction from the board as to how to move forward with this.
As I recall, he's an employee of the correctional system in California. This is an inmate who has sued everyone who works at the correctional facility, a whole list of guards and what have you, and this is an ongoing action for violation of civil rights or some such thing with that. Is there any discussion?
Well, I think the issue is that the claim was filed prior to the first time he asked for renewal, and he didn't state that he had had a claim against him. The second time he renewed, he did. So I think that's the issue.
As I looked at the timelines on it, it looked like the first time he filed with it, he had not been noticed of it, and it wasn't until they lost an appeal, and then he noticed on the second time. Dr. Flower.
Yes, that's my understanding as well. He apparently, it was under investigation, but he did not know.
Okay.
And so when he reapplied, he didn't know, so he answered honestly. And the second time around, he did talk about what was going on.
Correct. That's what the documentation said to me as I read it. Is there any further inquiry? And what we're asked, the board is, staff is asking is, can we renew his license?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we are.
Okay. Is there a motion?
I make a motion that his license be renewed.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Like sign. Motion carries. Staff, please renew doctor's license as we move along.
Thank you.
We have 5 minutes. Let's move right down the list. Item number 12, which is discussion, consideration, and action regarding Dr. Kansas. And
Mr. Chairman, she's coming at 10:30.
Oh, okay. I will mark that one down.
And item 13 is tied in at 10 a.m. Would you like a legislative update, number 17?
That would be wonderful, please.
Great. Mr. Chairman, board members, the legislative session has been very active. I provided an update of the cases as of earlier this week. I will tell you that yesterday the governor's bill, that 2569, to offer occupational licensing reciprocity did pass the Senate on an 18-11 vote. So it will be forward. It also has already passed the House 36-24. So it looks like that one is going to the governor's office for signing or consideration. The other bills continue to move. They have been put, the legislature is a bit behind because of the whole matter with the one member that resigned in the last week or two. So they are trying to catch up on a lot of bills in the Senate process. I talked with some people yesterday. they hope to catch up, but we probably will see the legislative session with the whole budget process next on the horizon going through the end of May. Unfortunately, the appropriations committees have concluded, and so there shouldn't be any new bills heard other than the budget bills. But I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any about other bills.
Any questions from board members on legislative pieces? The one that's moving rapidly and appears to be on its way to the governor's office will impact us. This is a bill that essentially says any psychologist, actually any healthcare professional, but that includes psychologists, who is licensed in another state for 1 year and has a no complaints filed, can apply here and automatically gets a license.
Mr. Chairman, board members, yes, we will have the opportunity to do a fingerprint card once we have that, if we get that legislative change next year. But yes, but I've also been confirmed that master's levels, this will not allow them to apply. It has to be at the same level of education. So
that was the mistake the Canadians put in their bill. You get licensed in one province, you can go to another. Two of the provinces had master's level, so everybody went, got licensed there, and then immediately applied for a license in another province and got it. It's created quite a scene up in Canada. All right, thank you very much. Any questions on legislation? Dr. Flower.
Yes, just want to make a comment. One thing I saw in there that is they have to move to Arizona and become a resident before they can apply and get that. So that may be interesting as well. So they can't be like in New York and apply under that law because they're not a resident yet.
I believe it requires that they move here and be a resident.
Mm-hmm. It requires a resident, yes.
Yeah.
There's some questions we're asking about clarification on that.
There's multiple questions that are going to go along in time, and we'll see if we can figure it out as it moves forward. All right. As I look at clock, it's now 8:45. We have a timed item, so we'll move to agenda item number 7. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding and relating to initial case reviews. I have to remind board members that the purpose of this initial review is for the board to determine whether or not there may be a violation of rule or statute. May be. The board may go into executive session on any item on this agenda pursuant to ARS 38-431-03-A2 to review confidential records and or ARS 38-431-03-A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. Individuals who wish to speak must have completed a request to speak form provided to the board staff, and you will be provided an opportunity to speak. Our first case, agenda item 7A, is complaint number 1831 pertaining to Dr. Tarantino. Are there any board members recusing from this?
Dr. Flowers.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm recusing.
Thank you. Please note Dr. Flowers leaving. Mr. Donaldson, you're the lead board member for this agenda item. Would you please provide the board with a factual overview of this case?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, how do you pronounce your last name?
Tenmero.
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 Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. this complaint was submitted by the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners, BBHE. Some background, a licensed associate counselor and applicant, JW, submitted his licensed professional counselor, LPC, application to the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners, BBHE. Dr. Tenrero provided applicant supervision. BBHE claims that Dr. Tenrero may have acted unethically and unprofessionally by not completing the verification form and signing the verification without verifying the hours. BBHE voted to forward the complaint to the board for further review of Dr. Dinero's conduct. The comment I'd like to make about this before I go into the full complaint is I thought the BBHE did a very excellent job in looking at this case and submitting information that we needed to help us make a decision on this. JW submitted an application to BBHE for his LPC license. The applicant was advised by Anna Broussard, LPC, LISAC, and Dr. Dinero. While reviewing the JW's application, BBHE's Counseling Academic Review Committee noted that the supervision documentation submitted by the applicant did not appear to be authentic. It was apparent that there were obvious and visible alterations. JW responded by stating that at the beginning of the supervision session, he did not have a blank supervision form. JW took an old form and covered the writing with paper and made copies of the form to create a blank form. JW confirmed that he made several blank forms in this manner. Applicant declared that his manipulation of the form was not meant to be malicious. BBHE noted that Ms. Broussard provided clinical supervision to the applicant from October 10, 2011 to December 13, 2013. As a result, BBHE noted the following. BBHE requires that clinical supervisor complete the supervision forms. In this case, JW completed the forms. The supervision hours did not correlate with the total supervision notes submitted by JW or Mrs. Broussard. The JW and Mrs. Broussard submitted training hours as group supervision. BBHE made note of the following with Dr. Tenero's supervision of the applicant, JW. The applicant completed the supervision forms. The supervision hours did not correlate with the total supervision notes submitted by JW or Dr. Tenero. The JW's number of notes that did not correlate with Dr. Nero's number of notes. Dr. Tenero utilized Horizon Healthcare supervision forms, whereas JW utilized BBHE's supervision forms. Dr. Tenero and JW's documented total hours did not correlate. The JW's documentation indicates individual supervision, whereas Dr. Tenero's documentation indicates that it is a group supervision. BBHE's interview of the applicant indicated the following. The JW explained his work as a contractor with Horizon Healthcare. The applicant stated that he works at the complex at the prison in Florence and described his job duties as follows. JW confirmed that he received group supervision on a regular basis and some individual supervision through his work. JW outlined his supervision with Dr. Narrows as follows. JW acknowledged that he is not familiar with BBHE's statutes and rules regarding supervision. JW presumed that Dr. Tenero was familiar with BBHE's supervision guidelines. JW indicated his supervision with Dr. Tenero included discussing client cases, self-care, short-term care of certain clients, employment-related issues. JW confirmed that he and Dr. Tenero utilized different supervision forms. Dr. Tenero noted the times of supervision. Topics discussed during supervision varied. JW confirmed that he and Dr. Tenero would sign his supervision forms at the end of the session, and he would sign Dr. Tenero's supervision forms. JW asserts that the supervision forms were dated at the time of the supervision. JW believes that supervision is both the supervisee and the supervisor's responsibility. JW divulges that Dr. Tenero indicated dates and hours on her supervision forms incorrectly. When asked why he and Dr. Tenero had different supervision notes, he acknowledged that he may have misplaced some of his notes. He confirmed that he and Dr. Tenero did not compare what documentation was being submitted in support of his application. JW states at the time of the supervision, he and Dr. Nero compared notes to assure that what was being provided to the board correlates. Additionally, he confirmed that if he indicated more supervision on a form, then his form was utilized and vice versa. JW acknowledged BBHE's concern with the appearance of the manipulated supervision forms. He reiterated that he reused O forms by placing paper over the writing and making blank copies. His intent to manipulate the form was not meant to mislead BBHE. JW does not know why he and Mrs. Bizard's submitted applications and information do not correlate. Neither he nor Mrs. Bizard were aware that training hours did not meet the group supervision requirement. JW was not aware of the discrepancy in hours until Mrs. Bizard received the subpoena from BBHE. JW thinks that Mrs. Bizard lost some of the documentation of his supervision. JW could not explain why he completed the supervision forms instead of Mrs. Bizard or Dr. Tenero. Applicant JW verified that his direct and indirect client contact hours was a rough estimate. BBHE staff interviewed Mrs. Bizard and noted the following. Mrs. Bizard indicated that she was familiar with the supervision guidelines. Ms. Bizard expressed concern with JW supervision documentation. Mrs. Bizard confirmed that she oversaw some of the group sessions. After group sessions, she would meet with JW for individual supervision to discuss his group session. She documented this time as individual notes instead of direct observation. Mrs. Bizard affirmed that supervision notes were signed as the supervision occurred. Mrs. Bizard declared that she gave JW a copy of all her supervision notes. When JW applied for his LPC license, neither of them worked at the place that the supervision occurred. Therefore, Mrs. Bizard no longer had the supervision forms. Mrs. Bizard affirmed that the training sessions were noted as a group supervision because she would discuss the sessions with JW. Mrs. Bizard confirmed that the applicant only conducted group therapy and individual therapy was provided on an as-needed basis. Mrs. Bizard asserted that the retention of the supervision documentation was a responsive of JW. Mrs. Bizard stated that she did not know why they verified the hours of direct and indirect client contact. Mrs. Bizard confirmed that she trusted the hours that the applicant submitted to her for verification. BBHE staff interviewed Dr. Tenero and noted the following. Her employment does not require that she provide supervision, but will provide supervision upon request. She confirmed that she utilized Corizon's supervision form to document JW supervision at the request of Corizon. She assumed JW would utilize his own forms for supervision. She confirmed that the majority of her supervision to JW was group supervision. She would directly observe JW and then have individual sessions with JW to discuss her observations. Dr. Tenero believed that JW was responsible for maintaining his supervision documentation. Dr. Tenero was aware that JW reused old supervision forms and signed the forms. Dr. Tenero indicated that she and JW compared documentation prior to JW submitting his LPC application. Dr. Tenero acknowledged that she only submitted her notes, not JW's, to BBHE and can understand why utilizing two different supervision forms can cause confusion. Dr. Tenero conceded that it is her responsibility to ensure that JW's documentation was in order. She declared that JW is trustworthy and would never try to deceive her or BBHE. Dr. Tenero stated that she did not track direct and indirect client hours. Dr. Tenero indicated she no longer has a calendar that she used to track JW supervision. She could not provide an explanation as to the discrepancy in the hours reported. Dr. Tenero admitted to signing off on the hours without verifying the hours and acknowledged that she may not be competent to provide supervision any longer. Dr. Tenero believed that BBHE's documentation requirements were the same as the board's. BBHE's investigative report offered the possible violation, but indicated the evidence presented to support the violation is not clear and convincing. The licensee responded in a timely manner through her attorney Charles Hover. Dr. Turnerow states that shortly after she received J.W.'s application, reviewed her supervision documentation of the applicant, J.W. Dr. Turnerow noted the description and hours and contacted J.W. She and J.W. compared documentation and noted that Dr. Turnerow possessed documentation that J.W. did not possess and vice versa. Dr. Turnerow indicated that she supervised J.W. for several years. Therefore, it is possible that she and J.W. lost some of the documentation. Dr. Turnerow asserts that for approximately 1 year of J.W.'s supervision, she was the lead psychologist for the Department of Corrections. This responsibility was in addition to her clinical supervisor role. Additionally, Dr. Turnerow continued to have a full caseload. Dr. Turnerow admitted that she could not keep up with her responsibilities and terminate her lead psychologist position. She continued to provide supervision and work her caseload. Dr. Turnerow affirmed that during the supervision of J.W., J.W. separated from the prison and ultimately divorced his spouse. Dr. Turnerow believes that J.W.'s situation is the cause of his lost supervision documentation. Dr. Turnerow confirms that she was able to verify J.W.'s hours when he submitted his application to BBHE. Dr. Turnerow notes that after the fact, she was made aware that the electronic health workers' records provide the information she was seeking. An analyst with the company provided the information to her. She reviewed from the information, she determined that J.W. had more hours than was reported on his LPC application. Dr. Turnerow confirms that she signed J.W.'s supervision verification form based on J.W.'s estimate of the hours. Dr. Turnerow declares that she trusts J.W. and believes that he is honest in reporting his hours. Dr. Turnerow asserts that if she did not trust J.W., she would not have provided several years of supervision. Additionally, he declares that she discusses ethics with all of her supervisees and particularly found J.W. to be very honest in the years she had known him. Dr. Turnerow states that she was present when J.W. manipulated old supervision forms to make new blank forms. She claims that J.W. was in a hurry and did not have time to go to an office to use a computer to print new forms off of BBHE's website. Dr. Turnerow concedes that the supervision notes were authentic and does not believe that J.W.'s actions were unethical. Dr. Turnerow confirmed that she and J.W. signed each other's forms after each supervision session. Dr. Turnerow acknowledges that she was unaware of BBHE and does not consider direct observation as individual supervision. Dr. Turnerow explains that immediately after her observations, she met with the supervisee individual to discuss her observations, therefore counted the entire time as individual supervision. Dr. Turnerow declares that no point in her supervision of J.W. or in signing J.W.'s LPC licensure application did she ever provide deceptive or false information. Dr. Turnerow signed J.W.'s application as testing that the information provided in the application was truthful and accurate to the extent that she could verify the information at the time. On February the 20th, 2019, the CSC reviewed and noted a disposition, expressed concern that Dr. Turnerow lost documentation and supervision she provided, and expressed concern that she did not retain adequate records. The CSC voted to forward complaint number 18-31 to the board for possible violation of ARS 32-2061H for possibly failing to or refusing to maintain and retain adequate business, financial, and professional records pertaining to the psychological services provided to a client or patient, and ARS 32-2061P for possibly falsely and fraudulently claiming to have performed a professional service, charging for a service or representing a service as the licensee's own when the licensee has not rendered the service or assumed supervisory responsibility for the service. There's additional supplemental information received from the licensee. It is important to note that on March 14, 2019, the board received supplemental information and documentation as follows. Dr. Nero affirms that the hours she verified for JW were the hours that she supervised. In no way was her verification of JW's hours false or fraudulent. Dr. De Niro acknowledged that BBHE's concern that both the JW and Dr. De Niro submitted different documentation of the applicant's hours. Dr. De Niro agreed to verify the documentation that was kept by JW because she worked with JW for many years and was certain that the applicant was trustworthy. Dr. De Niro acknowledged that she fell below the standard of keeping and securing her supervision documentation, but maintains that her verification of JW's hours was not deceitful or fraudulent. Dr. De Niro recognizes that sloppy record keeping could potentially prohibit an applicant from gaining licensure. Dr. De Niro admits that she could not handle her increased responsibilities and her supervisor responsibilities at the same time. Dr. De Niro has balanced her responsibilities and is determined to maintain a balance between her work and responsibilities and her supervisory responsibilities. Dr. De Niro emphasizes that her goal is to become a better clinical supervisor. In an effort to increase her knowledge, she completed the following continuing education. Record keeping and practice guidelines by APA, 2 hours. Ethical dilemmas encountered by members of APA, 3 hours. Clinical supervision refresher, 6 hours. Enhancing skills in competency-based supervision, 6 hours. Additionally, Dr. Tenero affirms that she has implemented a new record-keeping system, which includes the following. She utilizes a supervision folder to transport the documentation between her work and her home. She completes a supervision spreadsheet, which includes the time, date, and supervision information at her home office. Once the supervision spreadsheet is completed, she places the sign form in each of the supervisee's folders. Her supervisee's folders are stored in a locked filing cabinet at her home office. Her home computer is not shared and is password protected. Dr. Tenero is requesting that if the board determines that a violation occurred, she be issued a letter of concern or a non-disciplinary order for continued education. Mr. Chairman, board members, that completes my summary of RFI 18-31.
Thank you, Mr. Donaldson. Most complete. Is the complainant a representative of the Board of Behavioral Health here?
Hearing none.
We have Dr. Tenero and counsel. Would you introduce yourselves, please?
Yes. Good morning, Chair Bohansky, members of the board. My name is Charlie Hover. I'm an attorney for Dr. Tenero, who is sitting to my right.
And would you like to make a statement?
Yes, briefly. Thank you. Mr. Donaldson, thank you for your complete summary of the complaint and the responses to it. Just wanted to emphasize at this point in time that Dr. Tenero, from the outset, has understood and taken responsibility for the failure in her record keeping. She acknowledged this to the Complaint Screening Committee and took to heart what she heard in that discussion and followed up with even more continuing education after that meeting. That was in addition to the continuing education that she took upon learning that there had been a concern raised by the Board of Behavioral Health about her record keeping and the application process for her supervisee. In that, she has demonstrated, I believe, to this board a understanding of what is necessary for her to act as an appropriate and trustworthy supervisor for those seeking her supervision. She has also demonstrated, I believe, an understanding of what she needs to do to improve her practice and to become a better psychologist in the future. To this end, we do not at this time challenge the recommendation that there was a failure by Dr. Tenero in her record keeping, that it fell below the standard of care. What we do ask the board to do is to consider the circumstances. This was the first time she had ever had a supervisee. This was in a prison setting, which does not lend itself well to maintenance of records that are not prison related, and that her supervising was also stepped up when she took on the entire advisory and administrative capacity as the lead psychologist. That's not an excuse for her failures in that regard, but merely an explanation of the circumstances and, as I phrased it, kind of the perfect storm that confronted her in this particular situation. I think it is also important for the board to understand that Dr. Tenrero was absolutely convinced that her supervisee was a trustworthy individual. She had worked with him in a very stressful prison setting for a number of years, came to trust him and know his work and to understand him as a person. This is why she was comfortable in accepting the statements from him as to supervised hours for which she did not have paperwork. She also understood that some paperwork had gone missing from both her and the supervisee due to personal and professional circumstances. It was this trust that she was able to develop with him, however, that gave her the confidence and the absolute sincere belief that what she was reporting to the Board of Behavioral Health was, in fact, the hours that she spent supervising this person. She has come to understand, however, that that board and even this board do not have the personal relationship that she had with that supervisee so as to feel the same confidence that she had in his record keeping. She understands now, and I think it has been driven home very forcefully, that the Board of Behavioral Health and this board rely on her through her record keeping and demonstration of understanding of her responsibilities to have the comfort that what she is presenting and stating to the board is in fact correct, so that they can move forward with confidence that what they are approving as a licensee is someone who has actually received what has been required. So again, Dr. Tenrero understands and completely acknowledges that the failure in her record keeping was a failure not only of the technical requirements, but also of the ethical and moral requirements that the board is looking for in order to have confidence that what has been represented is in fact what happened. What I would ask the board to consider is whether or not the referral from the complaint screening committee with regard to an alleged failure of Section P, falsely or fraudulently claiming to have performed a professional service when the licensee has not rendered the service. There is no question, in my understanding, that Dr. Tenrero did in fact provide supervision for her supervisee. The question is whether or not the paperwork and the proof of that supervision met the standard that would provide the Board of Behavioral Health with the comfort that it needed and comply with her statutory requirements as a psychologist to keep proper and appropriate records. There is no question that Dr. Tenrero absolutely believed that what she was reporting was in fact true and correct hours based on the record keeping that she kept, based on the record keeping that the licensee or supervisee kept, and her long personal and professional relationship with this person, all combining to convince her that what she was reporting was true and accurate.
Can we finish up, please?
Certainly. Section P at least infers that there might have been an intent to provide false or misleading information, and that is clearly not the case in this particular circumstance. That's why we ask the board to consider that under all of the circumstances and given the efforts that have been made and put into it by Dr. Tenrero to mediate this issue, that a letter of concern documenting the board's concern be placed in her file, as opposed to going to the full disciplinary activity, which would, although memorialize the board's concerns, I think it would be perhaps in this one instance, under these circumstances, be excessive. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from board members?
Chairman?
Mr. Donaldson.
This is a question, Dr. Tenrero. Did JW get his license?
No, not yet.
And it's all contingent upon what this board and BBHE decides?
It's contingent on JW completing certain tasks that the board asked him to complete.
So it's these bumps in the road then will not affect his ability to get licensure? As long as he completes what they've asked him to do?
As far as I know, that's correct.
Thank you.
Ms. Shreve.
Just to confirm, though, if the records were complete, would he been asked to do these other tasks?
What do you mean if they were complete?
Well, if there were issues, obviously that board had issues with the documentation that was submitted. So if the documentation had been completed and everything matched, and would that have changed the outcome of his licensing?
Yes.
What do you think your role was as a supervisor?
In terms of his application for
Which is in survey, you agreed to be someone's supervisor, knowing that they're going for an application, you know, going to be applying for a professional license. What do you feel your role was?
My role was to maintain accurate records of the supervision. My role was to provide feedback and guidance in his practice of behavioral health. My role was also to be able to verify everything that was on that application for independent licensure.
When you accepted the opportunity, or when you accepted to be the supervisor, did you do research? How did you inform yourself? How did you understand what your role and requirements are legally? Did you do research? Did you know exactly what was needed?
Well, there is a course that is provided by ASU that the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners requires people to take in order to become a supervisor on their registry, and I took that course.
And did you follow through with what you learned in that course?
To the best of my ability, yes.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Hearing none, we'll go into deliberation, please. Thank you very much. Mr. Donaldson, could you start us off?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. As a public member, I have reviewed this case several times, both as CSC committee member and here today. It concerns me that because of the record keeping, it could affect JW's licensure. It puts him through a more kind of disciplinary action by BBHE, as I understand it. If, however, JW has moved on to licensure and he is will get his license in spite of the missteps of the record keeping, then we must decide acceptable disciplinary action based on these facts and Dr. Gennaro's honesty, genuineness, and truthfulness. Thank you.
Other comments from board members?
Yeah, it's discouraging. I mean, I guess, and I'm also represent the public. So, you know, to be a student, you go through all that. You do the, you know, you're having an internship or supervisory, and you expect, I think, in some aspect that the person supervising you understands their role and is going to fulfill those roles, and then to apply and not get accepted because there was not the appropriate supervision provided is just very disappointing. And I mean, I couldn't even imagine if I was that person. There is definitely a responsibility when you say you'll supervise, especially for a person that's getting their license, that you'll make sure that they follow those requirements. But I would say it's on both sides. I mean, also the student needs to take responsibility too. But as a supervisor, and even as, you know, in any kind of position as a manager, supervisor, you have, I think, a higher standard of what you're required to do and understand.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would also like to add, and I think mostly just as a discussion point, and I think for people to think about and hear, in some of the supervisory relationships, too, I think there are some other underlying ethical considerations that we don't think about, like multiple relationships. So when we make decisions based off of a judgment of character, or our personal experience with somebody, that I think this is where we can easily kind of get taken down this road versus really thinking about our role as supervisors in a way that requires us to maintain objective professional relationships.
I see a lot of students in the audience, and I just, you know, I think that this is one of those things when you're listening to these discussions that, you know, supervision, the act of supervision, going through the process of supervision, the rules and regulations around supervision need to be attended to by all parties. And, you know, I echo Mr. Donaldson's concerns that individuals that are working towards professional licensure that encounter, you know, shortcomings on their end or on their supervisor's end really is a detriment to getting professionals into the field where we greatly need them in the workforce.
I'd make a couple observations. I have no idea if the clinical consulting that you did was a professional and adequate. I'm assuming it is. That the issue here is one of documentation. It's entirely possible you held wonderful sessions and consulted on difficult cases and contributed incredibly to the learning of assessment and interventions and everything with this student. That's possible. That no one suggests here that you didn't do that. But times have changed. When I went through my training, which is more decades ago than I care to recall, we did supervision in a hot tub, and nothing was documented. That was California in the 60s and 70s. It was very different. Today, we've got a very different environment, and we have very strict rules which have been implemented over time that we have to follow. And one of the strictest set of rules that I'm aware of is in the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners in this state. And if we're psychologists going to share our clinical knowledge and skills and abilities and supervise folks under that board, we damn well ought to do it representing our whole field and do it properly and document it properly according to the way they want it. And they want more than just that course in supervision. They want ongoing continuing education supervision. They now have a website you have to go to and another course you have to take of theirs on there. There are a lot of requirements if you want to take on the supervision of those folks, because it impacts them. They become a consumer just like our clients do. He's a consumer. Your student is a consumer. And if you don't document properly and work collaboratively in that process of application, their license is in jeopardy, as has happened here. And that's the concern that I have. I don't question the quality of what you did with him. I question the quality of your documentation. The quality of your documentation, I think, leaves much to be desired. The steps in remediation that you've made, the courses that you've taken, and the content that you've provided for the board to review of what that involved are the kind of things that I would have recommended that you undertake. So those are my thoughts. Are there any other comments? Hearing none, is there anyone who has a motion? Is do we have a clear violation of statute or rules? And if it's not clear for you, do we want to suggest a non-disciplinary letter of concern as her counsel has recommended?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Donaldson?
Any action, in my opinion, as a public member, hinges on whether these missteps causes JW to not be licensed. That really concerns me. And it's for Dr. Tenero, being in a supervisor position, any psychologist that makes the kinds of errors that the good doctor here has made reflects on the entire psychological organization. As out there in the field, the public assumes that, well, Dr. Tenero represents all of us, and her actions represent us. I know when I was being supervised, my supervisor told me not to do anything that I would be embarrassed if it was on the 6 o'clock news. And that kept me from doing a lot of stuff.
Thank God.
Chairman?
Ms. Shreve.
You know, I do think there's a failing in maintaining accurate records. That is clear. You know, I think providing the other concern that I think the committee had was possibly falsely or fraudulently claiming to have performed professional services. Yeah, I don't see fraudulently. I don't see that. But what I do see clearly is failing to maintain and retain adequate business, financial, or professional records pertaining to the psychology services performed to a client or patient. There's a responsibility when you take on a supervisor role. You know, there just is. And so I just think that there's a accountability with taking on that role. I mean, it's great that you do it. I think it's a wonderful thing. We need supervisors, but there's also, you know, there's an accountability of it. So I mean, if there's an issue I have, it's with that. Do I think it was, you know, fraudulent? No. Do I feel, you know, I just think that what we have is a lack of detail, maybe a lack of knowledge, but that's their responsibility. And whether the person got the license or not doesn't really pertain to me. I don't see that as a weighing as much as it's a concern that it could have kept him from getting his license. You know, the issue is there a potential rule or law broken? That would be the one I'd see. So I'd make a motion.
Please.
I'd make a motion that we move it to the full board with a violation of ARS 32-206-1H for possible failing or refusing to maintain and retain adequate business, financial, or professional records pertaining to the psychological services provided to a client or patient. Is that considered, I guess, is a supervisee considered a client or patient?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. That would be my...
Is there a second?
I would second that.
We have a motion and a second. Do we need a roll call?
Yes, I'm sorry. So you were moving it to the full board for informal interview? Did I hear that correctly? Or for...
Well, I think this was for yes, to the full board for further discussion. I thought our purpose was to find if there's an issue. And then
okay.
We take it to the next level as an what's the word, Dr. Wohansky, the next
informal.
Investigation? Formal. Hmm. To take it to a formal hearing.
Informal interview?
Informal, yeah.
Formal interview. Thank you for keeping me straight.
Okay. Roll call.
Dr. Boganski?
Yes.
Dr. Flowers?
He's recused.
Sorry. Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Mr. Donaldson?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
You have a motion carries.
Motion carries. Thank you very much. Staff will be in touch. That concludes 17A. We'd like to now, or 7A, we'll like to move on to agenda item 7B, which is complaint number 1833 pertaining to Dr. Menger. Are there any board members recusing from this case?
May I get Mr. Dr. Flowers?
Yeah, we need Dr. Flowers. I'm just going to try to set up while we get Dr. Flowers back in.
No other
recusals? Excellent. We missed you.
Yes, we did. You're the lead on the next one.
But now that we have you back, Dr. Flower, we have agenda item 7B, Dr. Manger's case. And you are the lead for this agenda item. Could you please provide us with a factual overview of the case?
Yes, members of the board. This is the initial case review of complaint number 18-33 involving Dr. Mark Major and complainant J.Y. I'm the lead board member in this case and will provide a brief factual overview. The complaint stems from a case involving a court-ordered intensive psychotherapy. On May 26, 2017, the court appointed Dr. Major to provide intensive psychotherapy to the complainant. It was to begin October 2017 and was scheduled to end in April 2018. Dr. Major was required to update the court every 2 months in regards to the court-ordered psychotherapy. J.Y. said that the psychotherapy was to advance his visitation with his daughter. The complaint alleges that Dr. Major did not provide any updates to the court, that he continually canceled appointments even though J.Y. traveled from California to receive the services, that Dr. Major sent a text message to J.Y. posing as a son, stating that he needed to cancel a session due to an illness. And then beginning in April 2018, Dr. Major did not respond to correspondence from J.Y. In response from Dr. Major, he said that he was to provide 6 months of services to J.Y., that J.Y. signed the service plan on September 18, 2017. Dr. Major said that the first session took place on November 12, 2017, and during the session, it was determined that the services would extend until October. Dr. Major said that J.Y. traveled to Arizona to visit his daughter, and it was during this time that J.Y. would request sessions with Dr. Major. Dr. Major said that most of the communications with J.Y. were conducted using landline phones. Dr. Major said that his services were concluded in October 2018 and that the report was written by the end of October 2018. He said that the report was electronically resubmitted on the 2nd of December 2018. This concludes my overview of the case.
Thank you very much. Is the claimant? No. Okay. With them not being here, Dr. Major, could you introduce yourself, please, and counsel?
Good morning. It's been a while. For those of you who may not remember, Charlie Hover, attorney for Dr. Major, who is sitting to my right.
Would you like to make a statement, please?
Yes, just briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Flowers, thank you for your summary. One point that I do want to make at the outset is that there is some confusion as to the nature of the order to Dr. Major about the nature and extent of his duties to the court. The order is silent as to monthly reports. It merely appointed Dr. Major and then required him to make a report at the end. There may have been some confusion on the client's behalf, who was looking at, I believe, a description of a therapeutic interventionist requirements on the website. This was not the duty assumed by or the subject of the appointment by the court. What we do have here, however, is a communication issue, which we acknowledge on behalf of Dr. Major, and the question as to whether or not he should have responded more timely. We acknowledge that that was problematic and that it should have been done. But in the end, the services were provided and the report made to the court as ordered and appropriately so. With that, any questions for Dr. Major? He's happy to answer.
Thank you. Are there questions from board members? Dr. Flowers.
Yes, I have some. Good morning. Thank you for coming. Your role in this case was a little bit unclear to me because on a court order earlier on, it looks as if it was like February 27th, it said that there would be a therapist that would provide written updates to the parties, counsel of record, at least every 60 days. And later, there was a court order designated you, I believe, to, as having that role. Or is that incorrect?
I think that the first the first letter or the first appointment from the court that you're referring to, there were things that were in flux about whether what kind of therapist there was going to be, what it was required. The client, JY, had gone ahead and had therapy with someone that was approved by courts in California. That was at a master's level and also went through groups such as that seemed somewhat equivocal to anger management kinds of groups that would be the types that, although this did not involve DCS, okay, but that would be similar to those sorts of groups. So he jumped ahead with that. So what was being required, you know, that just wasn't clear whether they were going to allow that to stand or not. And eventually they didn't. They wanted a doctoral level person that would, my understanding was, that would write a report at the end.
Okay. You know, it appears, though, that there was a court order that the two parties, I guess, spouse and husband, I guess, who were estranged, that they would find somebody to take that role and that would provide, like, every 60 days an update. And then the minute entry for you, the 26th of May, did not reference the other court order, but I wondered if it was the same. Does it refer to you, or do you just not know?
Yeah, I don't know who the initial was referred to. This, not that it makes that much difference, but there, I mean, this wasn't the husband and spouse situation, and his agreeing to come in to therapy involving an Arizona person.
Okay, because it's somewhat confusing. I know on the minute court entry, it didn't say anything about providing updates.
Right. Or anything like that. I think it was in August that he thought that he got the notion about therapeutic interventionist. That may wind up, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, that could wind up being something that gets assigned later by the court, not involving me. But and I don't know how exactly that would work out.
Okay, it could be that he was confused about who did what.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, were you asked to provide recommendations for child visitation by the court system? Because it appeared that at the end you did.
I provided recommendations or areas of concern because the, as had been raised at the evaluation, at the individual psychological evaluation of him, there was not a comprehensive psychological evaluation or even an evaluation of mother, which the evaluation that was done of him had involved an interview with mother and very, very clear, forceful, well put together argument about the need for mother to be evaluated and in therapy. And there was no comment on it, so I raised issues of concern.
Okay, but you didn't provide services to her or to the daughter in question, right?
Correct. I did not. And at that point in time, from father's report, there were no services that were being provided to the daughter, although father presented material and you know, what he was upset with and what he was trying to deal with in terms of what was going on in there. And so those were raised issues, but you know, without seeing or doing that evaluation, which was well beyond the purview of this, that whole aspect of which was core was up in the wind.
Okay, wondering too, the issue about, you know, the client indeed showed a lot of emails and text messages corresponding with you, but I didn't really see that you respond to those when he was asking repeatedly about where's the report and all that.
So in the the report that was done that wound up a few years ago that wound up generating the court requiring the therapy for him, there was well-established pattern of tremendous amounts of email and texting in particular that he and mother would engage in and also use very flowerful, and I don't mean that euphemistically, but very flowerful metaphoric language that was, if you only read the first couple of pages, you'd think, oh my gosh, you know, we're looking at someone that is of a different, on both of their parts, because they were talking about Dungeon and Dragon characters and this Dungeon and Dragon characters and this and that when they were insulting each other. They didn't mean, it was clear if you read through all of it, which was like maybe 50 or 100 pages of this stuff, that they were using that as simile and as metaphor, not that they were delusional. However, this pattern of engaging and then not being able to break away once they started that kind of a thing, I was well aware of coming into it with him, and I wasn't going to get into a lot of that with him.
But I guess, though, what I'm saying is they were like messages to you and not including her, where he just kept repeatedly saying, I'm looking for the report, I'm looking to the report, how is it coming? But I didn't see any response from you to him on that.
Right. And a good deal of my communication with him was by phone, because I didn't want to have a lot of that stuff going on in terms of this relentless emailing from him. And
because it would strike me that if there were like phone therapy sessions or whatever you were having, as he said, it was after, I think, March. They went till October, I think,
right.
He said. I would think that would be mentioned during the course of the conversation, but it doesn't say anything about that.
In the first session with him, there was a revision of the basic plan, because the basic plan or the service agreement that was presented out there before sort of meeting him was different than spending some time in assessment with him.
Okay, also I'm wondering, looking at the notes, I didn't really see a psychodiagnostic interview or diagnosis, and then in the other notes didn't really see mental status examinations or an informed consent. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, informed consent was as a part of that one page, the handwritten page from the first meeting with him, and to some extent, in terms of the service agreement before we met. And then in terms of mental status evaluation, that was somewhat in that first session, and then later on in the course of meeting with him, there was an update of testing with him, as well as evaluation. And what I used for, I believe I used for notes for the mental status were a little redundant. I mean, it's two sets of notes, some of the two sets of forms. One was from University of Miami, Jackson Memorial Medical Center, initially. That's where the basic blueprint of that came from, checkoffs for mental status and so on. And then the other, which is somewhat redundant, is a form that I used when I was doing consultations in nursing homes and things like that. So there are a lot of checkoff boxes and then some places for more descriptive as well as some running notes with that. You know, in terms of hallucination, you know, all the general thing.
But I guess what I'm saying is within each session, I didn't really see anything about that. It didn't seem to be there. And some of them also were pretty hard to read. You know, they were kind of scribbly looking. And, you know, my only other question, I'm sure other staff members or board members will want to ask some questions as well, but... And I think during the previous screen we had with you, we were concerned about what appeared to be a message from your son regarding, you know, your illness that you couldn't meet, and then he seemed to know about you. Your son knew about the case and so forth and talked about, don't worry, you're a great guy, he has your back, and that kind of thing. And it just concerned me that, you know, you might have been sharing client information with somebody who should not know. So those are my questions, other board members.
Can you answer the question? I mean, I guess that could you address the email that supposedly was from your son?
The text that was from my son? Yeah. It was, he was, in his words, explaining that I would catch up with him and have his back in that kind of a colloquial expression. Some flowery language.
Okay, I just wanted to go back to the informed consent, because you're very general. It's like, well, there was a form, it was handwritten. Is there an actual informed consent form that you had him sign?
Well, just the handwritten one.
Okay, and then, and I represent the public, so I'm not a psychologist, but even when I read it, I had the same concerns Dr. Flower did about the diagnostics. It seemed very general. There's a couple pages describing different psychological evaluations. You know, more, it's more like a, reminded me of like you're trying to teach someone what these different do, and then the synopsis was very brief, and I didn't see any of the detail. What did you do any testing, and do you often give clients that aren't in a nursing home a nursing home evaluation?
No. It's just a template for like orientation, that kind of thing.
What about the diagnostic tests?
The diagnostic tests were both what I reviewed from the previous psychologist evaluation and what I administered was delineated in the report and in my copy of the, in the notes. I believe there's the actual protocols there, for example, back depression inventory, et cetera, et cetera.
I didn't understand a thing about Dungeons and Dragons and delusional texting, but it's irrelevant to me.
Okay.
As I look at this, and I'm just going to read a few of these to you, because I don't understand this. May 2nd, Dr. Major, how's my report coming? No response. May 9th, hi, Dr. Major, any news on my report? No response. May 21st, hey, Dr. Major, how's the report coming? No response. June 5th, hi, Dr. Major, I really need the report as soon as possible, with an emoji for praying. No response. Hi, Dr. Major. Can I please have my report on June 19th? No response. Dr. Major, on June 30th, I'm still waiting for the report. No response. Dr. Major, on June... It goes through July. A constant contact here from May through July of I need my report. Where's my report? And then frustration sets in, and you get sent a certified letter, which is signed for, and there's no response. And it goes on and on with, I don't understand how that's being in any way responsible to a case that involves the courts and involves custody and involves important matters that are being decided. How do you explain your non-responsiveness?
I was still meeting with him telephonically during that time. And, I've had a good deal of time to look back, to think back over it, that there were certainly better ways to have dealt with it, including
responding to him.
Responding to him through the attorneys.
Did you do that?
I had conversation with one attorney. I couldn't get a hold of the other attorney, and we were meeting on. And we had met on the phone.
And you don't keep progress notes in which you track contacts and phone calls and what have you that give us a running description of what's going on in a psychotherapeutic context.
In this case, not well enough. No.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions from. Dr. Meyer.
Dr. Major, how many sessions did you have with him?
I had 6 face-to-face sessions with him and another 12 telephonic. And the face-to-face sessions varied in terms of length of time. The testing took a great deal more time. The initial,
And the order was for 12 sessions.
Now, the order was for the order was very vague. The order was to deal with this matter.
I thought I saw 12 sessions. Was the contract? Did I miss that?
Well, there was an initial contract, and then which was prior to meeting with him, and then there was when we. The time of our first actual session.
The court ordered 12 sessions, right?
No. No.
Okay. So when was the last session that you had?
I believe it was in October.
So why was he asking for a report in May and June and July?
I think he was trying to push things ahead further. Hoping that he could move matters during the summer in terms of things with regard to the custody and or whatever kind of pleadings or arguments he was going to be making in family court before the school year started.
Okay. So last question is, was there a date range for when these sessions were to be completed?
No. No. By the court, no.
Okay. Thank you.
And initially, the requirement by the court for him to be in therapy was two things were happening, from my understanding of looking over things. What was being mulled over by the court and him, and he went ahead and engaged therapy without getting it okay that it was an out-of-state person, because that's where he was living. So there was some, I think it took time for till the court decided, there was an expansive time that passed until the court decided that he had to do it again and with somebody from Arizona.
Okay, so I guess one more question then. Your contract with him says 12 sessions over 6 months. But I don't see an amended contract or any information about the dates or the number of sessions was going to be extended.
That would be in the treatment service plan that was dated on the time of the first session. handwritten. There's a lot that's written in a small space.
Okay, I'll look for that. Thank you.
Dr. Davidson. My question was going to be similar in that I'm still confused with the dates as well, in that at the beginning of this conversation, the question was posed as to whether or not services were provided beyond April. And the response to the question, as I recall, was that there was a verbal statement that an additional 6 months would be provided. I'm still confused as to where documentation related to services from April to October exist, because everything that we have is related to a non-response. So as far as continued ongoing phone counseling for the summer months, I'm not clear where that is in the documentation or the service agreements either.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's on it's PDF 67. It's like the initial interview you had with a client, just kind of handwritten. If you look carefully, it'll say individual sessions, face-to-face, once a month for 6 months, and then telepsych by phone for 12 months.
Okay.
So it sounds as if you're doing both for a while and then just the phone.
Correct.
From what I understand. And then it talks about, indeed, it said you do one report at the end. It appears that the client did sign that. I don't know that he totally understood it, judged by what he later said. From what I gather, the last session is like a 5 or 6 hour session. We did massive testing, and that was the last in-person contact you had with him, as I understand it. And then after that, it was just phone calls.
There may have been another face-to-face session after that.
Okay, because you did talk about one of the communications from him was, we finished everything, I did all the testing, now it's time for you to do the report. And I think in his mind that was it. So it's confusing as, if he fully understood what he's signing here. It doesn't look like a formal treatment.
But what it does, can I interrupt just for a second? I'm sorry. But at the end of this, it says, Dr. Major, to communicate and send report at end of treatment or end of October 2018 to attorneys as well. Laura Gill is something, but it says right there when the report's due, the very end, very last sentence before the signature line.
Yes, and indeed, that may not be what the court wanted, but it looks as if there was at least an agreement between you and the client for that. It doesn't look like a formal plan. It's put together like you had a conversation, but again, it's not really, I think, within standards of documentation, especially since the client didn't seem to understand it. And I would hope that if a client repeatedly would ask for something, say, where is it, you would remind him and give information rather than not respond.
But the document right above that one does talk about it's a 12-week session, 12 sessions over 6 months, some face-to-face and some others. So, as the public, there's an expectation, and I represent the public. You're the professional. Your client is asking you, where's the report? Your client, maybe based on the email that you can read, is it's a 12 session over 6 months. And then he's thinking there's, he's in court, he's looking for, custody or partial custody. The lack of, concerns me is the lack of response to the customer. Even if it's written here, why aren't they responding to them? And also, to me, the diagnostics and stuff I have concerns about.
Doctor, this was a psychotherapy case? For seeing individual psychotherapy. And as part of that, you gave the Raytan Indiana?
I like to use that as a general screen.
And you also gave a bender?
Correct.
And an incomplete sentence blank?
Correct.
That was part of screening?
Well, it's also a follow-up to issues that had been raised in the initial evaluation.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you
very much for putting up with our questions. Dr. Flower, would you start our deliberation?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned about this case for a lot of reasons. I think we've kind of spelled them out. There are concerns about not responding adequately to the client's request for information. There appeared to be a lack of clarity exactly about who would do what. The client was at one point saying that he was a therapeutic interventionist, which apparently he was not. I'm confused, though, because he did make a recommendation in regards to child visitation, even though I didn't see that he was asked by the court to do that kind of thing. The notes as far as client care seem quite inadequate to me. And then the concern about the son knowing about the case to some degree, that's concerning. That's kind of a leakage of confidential information. It doesn't appear that it made the patient angry. Maybe it made him confused because he wondered, he said he thought his son was posing as you or the other way around. But it still speaks of difficulties as far as confidentiality. So I'm concerned that there indeed is a violation here.
Thank you. Other discussion?
I would concur with Dr. Flower's comments.
It's probably the worst set of progress notes that I've seen in 10 years sitting here. It's rather remarkable that this would pass as a professional file. Just on the records alone, I'm shocked. And that concerns me. The practice pieces in terms of a psychotherapy case with essentially a front-end neuropsych aphasia battery and on with benders and incomplete sentence blanks and what have you, I'm not sure why that goes as part of psychotherapy. On the record keeping and the failure to communicate with a client, even to acknowledge receipt of something, is disappointing. Any other comments from board members?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion.
Dr. Flower.
Yes, that the complaint be referred to an informal hearing for possible violations of ARS 32-2061-15 on professional conduct for possibly failing or refusing to maintain and retain adequate business, financial, or other professional records pertaining to the psychological services provided to a client or patient, and O, for possibly providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe, or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice. And ARS 32-261CC for possibly failing to make available to a client or patient or the client's or patient's designated representative or written request a copy of the client's or patient records including raw test data, psychometric testing materials, and other information as provided by law.
Is there a second to the motion?
Seconded.
We have a motion and a second. We need a roll call vote.
Dr. Bohansky?
Yes.
Dr. Flowers?
Yes.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Mr. Donaldson?
Yes.
Dr. Myers?
Yes.
Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, motion carries.
Thank you very much. Board staff will be in contact. I'm going to just make an educational statement because of students in the room and what they've just heard, and then I'm going to ask for a comfort break because I think we've been sitting here for a bit. When we do clinical work, a rule of thumb that I've always followed is, especially in therapy cases, is to keep notes clear enough that if I didn't make it home from work that day, someone else could pick up my practice and and know what I was doing with the case. I think that's a standard that's not in the ethics, but I don't plan to live forever. And that could happen to any of us at any time. And to not have records that are clear enough that somebody could pick up your treatment, I think is a lesson for all of us to keep in mind, is it's got to be clear. Let's.
And Mr. Chair, on that note, I will just add that the behavior analyst ethics do actually cover that. So it is definitely, if you are a behavior analyst or working towards behavior analysis, it is covered in the ethics, right. Very similar to how you stated it.
Good teaching point. Thank you. Let's take a comfort break. 15 minutes. Let's come back into order, if we could, please. And moving with chair's discretion, I'm going to do agenda item number 8. Dr. Meyer, would you please provide an update for the board on Elizabeth Bacon, PhD?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Dr. Bacon initially applied for licensure by waiver in September 2018. There was a request for additional information due to questions about her education at University of California, San Diego. This was not an APA accredited program. It was not the joint CID program. So we requested additional information about her coursework. And then there were also questions about a formal internship. She resubmitted that information. We reviewed again in March 2019 and again found that her education may not meet the requirements of statutes. Nor was there a formal internship that occurred after her training. Subsequently, she has submitted a request to withdraw her application.
Okay. Hey, I understand doctors on the line.
I am.
Would you like to make a statement, Dr. Bacon?
I would love a subordinate review that letter and outlining some of the lack of clarity of specific requirements for coursework or internships when applying from out of state from a non-APA accredited program, which isn't required, is sort of up to the board's discretion, but the requirements for that are rather vague, so it can be tricky to figure
out exactly what is needed, and if there's any way that the board to consider additional coursework, I might need to take this up. I'd love to have that consideration. Is there any questions for doctor or discussion? Dr. Flower.
Yes, I guess I believe you got a letter from the board discussing some of the concerns. One was the training itself. It didn't appear to be in an applied psychology area. I did see a letter from somebody at your university describing what you did accomplish, who did receive, but it didn't really specifically answer the question, you know, if it was a course or program designed to teach practice of health psychology type thing. I believe that the requirements for out-of-state people are really the same as those that are in-state. So I'm not sure where the lack of clarity would be in there. I mean, there are times when people have already finished their ECCC and so forth, and so they're considered waiver candidates, but that's only a waiver in regards to taking the ECCC, which you have done. And indeed, it can be frustrating if you're already licensed in another state. I believe you're licensed in California. Then it's like, why on earth is Arizona different? The rules here are different, even though I can see that would be pretty annoying, to say the least.
Thank you.
Other thoughts, concerns, questions? So the request
it's
at this...
It's very difficult to hear those that are not near the microphone, I suppose. I didn't catch much of that response.
Oh, she didn't, you didn't hear me? Okay, I'm not... Okay, I'm not sure what to repeat, otherwise it's unfortunate what's going on. You do have a CID, that's a great accomplishment. On the other hand, it has to be in a practice area. Behavior analyst is a great area. And, you know, I'm not a behavior analyst, but you could apply for that probably in Arizona and most likely have it approved. I'm not sure, as far as the out-of-state issue, if you... we're a resident, there may be a stipulation coming down the road to redress that, but that would be for somebody who's established Arizona residence, and it's a law that's not currently in existence, but it could be in a few months. And so that may be something else to pursue at a later date. But with the current statutes we have, you know, you're not really qualified as far as I can tell. That may sound like double talk.
All right, the question before the board is whether or not to accept the withdrawal of the application rather than deny it. Is there a motion?
I would make a motion to accept the withdrawal of her application.
I second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you very much. Motion carries. Continuing on, Dr. Meyer, we have a item number 9. Which is from Dr. Tinnis. Could you please provide an update to the board on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is Dr. Tinnis on the phone?
I'm right
here. Here in person.
Thank you.
Want to come forward?
Welcome. Dr. Tinnis applied to take the ECCC and licensure, which was reviewed on March 1st, 2019. There were concerns about his educational program. He received a master's and PhD in general psychology from Capella University. This program was not APA accredited, nor was it an applied psychology program. He submitted the handbook for the program, and it specifically states that the requirements for the general psychology specialization are not designed to prepare graduates for licensure as professional counselors or psychologists. And his transcript confirms that the specialization was in general psychology. In addition, there were no clinical practicums during his doctoral program. And so the finding was that his education was not sufficient for licensure.
Yes. I have seen applicants from that school offers a PsyD and a PhD. The PsyD is for practice. The PhD that they offer is for research and teaching. And their catalog specifically quotes. I can see Dr. Malott sitting here reading it to us, saying this degree is not for licensure. The confounding thing is that up until January of... next year, the California board has to accept it. They've changed their statute, so after that, it will not accept it. So some folks have gotten licensed in California, despite the fact that it says that. But it does not hit our rule. Is there any other discussion, or Doctor, would you like to make a statement?
I just wanted to ask what I was trying to figure out what procedures are for trying to fix that. Apart from getting an entire, you have to get an entire other PSID, or can I go back and do that residency and like patch it up through, there's an APA accredited school that I was looking at in California, and they offer a residency in a similar, I was gonna work in the prison system, so they have a residency at the Perryville prison just down the street. So I was seeing, is there some way that I could like meet all the, because when I look through the education, like each course, I have all of the education requirements. I'm just curious about maybe patching it up.
I can give you an idea of what we've typically looked at, but not guarantee anything unless you put it together with a school.
Okay.
And that is many psychologists, and there are several here in Arizona you could talk to, have been trained in an area of psychology and chosen to what we informally call retread or respecialize. And they contact a university. Many universities actually recruit, allow, encourage respecialization. And they review with you what you've accomplished and what would be required for that respecialization. And it may involve some coursework, it may involve an internship or residency. It has varying requirements depending upon your experience and background, and to not waste the general knowledge stuff that you picked up. If you can put together a respecialization program that's agreed to with the university, such applications for such here then are reviewed based upon the respecialization.
Is that something that I could go and put together in writing and then submit back to the board in a couple of months when I get that figured out?
From the university, you'd have to demonstrate that you're in that respecialization, and then if you complete, especially in an APA-approved program, a respecialization, the time to submit to the board is when the application is ready.
Okay.
That's helpful.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll take it from there. I don't have any other questions.
Thank you very much. Is there an application we need to act on?
Unless he chooses to withdraw.
We can't give advice, but I can give you options.
Okay.
If you do not withdraw the application, it goes down as a denial, and that goes on your permanent record as having been denied by the board. If you do withdraw the application, then it's free to start over again with nothing saying that you'd ever been.
Okay, I'll withdraw.
We have a request from an applicant to withdraw. Do I have a motion to accept that request?
I'll make the motion to accept that request.
Is there a second?
Seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Good choice. Thank you very much. Okay. I believe we have a item 24 that is...
Mr. Chairman, yes, I thought Mr. Hover would be here for that, but I guess he's chosen not to be.
All right. Well, it's scheduled for now, so we're going to proceed with it.
It's not time specific, but yes, you may hold him around this time.
I just want to get this off our plate.
Yes, sir.
Item 24 is a discussion consideration action regarding correspondence received from legal counsel for Dr. Gray regarding RFI 1615, in an attempt to consider settlement negotiations or avoid or resolve litigation. Ms. Kahn, would you provide an update for the board, please?
You know, I'd be glad to provide legal advice in executive session if the board would like that.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I mislabeled it on the agenda. I will provide a summary if that's okay.
If you could please provide us with a summary.
In April of 2016, the board received an anonymous complaint regarding Dr. Gray. The complaint was processed and sent to Dr. Gray for a response. Dr. Gray did not believe the board should accept an anonymous complaint. He felt the RFI request for information violated the constitutional guarantee of due process and equal protection. He did not appear at the respond or appear at the CSC meeting later that year. And the board or the committee actually requested that he attend. And the day before that committee meeting was to be held, the board office was served with documents indicating that Dr. Gray had filed a matter with the Superior Court with a request for special action relief, as well as an order by the judge staying the matter. The Superior Court did not find in Dr. Gray's favor. At that point, he appealed it to the Arizona Court of Appeals. In February of 18, the Court of Appeals dismissed his actions for lack of jurisdiction and denied his request to treat the appeal as a special action. He then filed a motion for summary judgment with the Superior Court, and those were also denied. At this point, Mr. Hover, counsel for Dr. Gray, is proposing a settlement wherein Dr. Gray would not appeal the court's decision, and if the board would agree to dismiss the underlying complaint. I provided you a copy of the underlying anonymous complaint. Mr. Hover has indicated that Dr. Gray is no longer associated with this office and has retired and no longer supervises students. I attached that letter for your information.
So if I could put this in English, we have a complaint from a member of the public who's concerned. The member of the public chose not to identify themselves. Doctor believes that that violates his rights and crosses out our jurisdiction. It's been tried at multiple court levels, and the board's position has been upheld. Now, in exchange for dismissing the complaint from the public, he's offering to not file any more appeals. That's the gist of it in English. There's a wise attorney general who normally sits in that seat next to you, Ms. Jones, who always is cautioning me about setting precedent by doing something stupid. And the precedent I don't want to set is that you can try this board until we're tired of appeals and we'll give in and not pursue a complaint against you. So unless there's other discussion or other ideas on this board, I would move that we reject the settlement offer and allow the good doctor to appeal to whatever superior court he believes he can finally win in, because I believe the voice of the public in expressing a concern is, in fact, a valid issue.
And I'd like to second that as a public member.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, do we need a roll call vote? Could I have a roll call vote, please?
Dr. Bohansky?
Yes.
Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
Dr. Flowers?
Yes.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Mr. Donaldson?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the vote is 7 ayes to 0 nays.
Thank you. I would ask staff to please inform the good counsel that the board has respectfully rejected his settlement request.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. I'd like to then move on to, I think the next thing we have scheduled is agenda item number 12, if I'm correct.
Yes, I do not have her signed in yet. I know she was driving up from Tucson.
We were holding her for, okay. So we'll give her a few more minutes to get here. Dr. Davies, can you proceed with 21?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This application is brought forth by the Committee of Behavior Analysts as part of their application review. We have an application from one Ms. Tracy Webb, who is seeking licensure as a behavior analyst in the state of Arizona. In reviewing this, several items were noted by the review committee, and one in particular, we were hoping to seek some further advice from the Attorney General. The items of note were the fact that the it's number 20 on the application, did they complete 1,500 hours in 12 or more months? The applicant indicated that it was actually done in 11 months. Further, we had a BCBA who resides in Kentucky named as the supervisor for experience towards certification. However, that individual was not able to be reached by the applicant, and instead we received a letter from the individual that from an individual that worked at the site or the agency where this individual received her supervision. It was a very brief email and just simply stated that they are the record keeper of the information that Ms. Webb references. This individual then had signed the application attesting to the fact that they were knowledgeable of the individual's supervision experience. That raised some questions. The committee ultimately asked board staff, which they willingly did, to engage the licensee to provide their BCBA supervision forms as verification of supervision, which through rule changes is now something that is one of the mechanisms, one of the levers we can pull to better understand someone's supervision experience. From the time that the committee met until today, we've received those documents. They appear to be in order. They are signed and verified as supervision occurring, and that is a summary of where we stand. I don't know if Dr. Davis Wilson would like to add anything to that.
Well, Mr. Chair, because we were having a discrepancy amongst the documentation and our meeting was scheduled for Friday but postponed till Monday afternoon, we just saw it fit to just move this application for today's review so that we could make a determination of whether or not this applicant, rather than hold the application. Some of the questions that we had related to the application are more of ones that we had some concerns related to the length of time that supervision was done. However, under the new rules, there is not any requirements that would allow for us to really take action on the supervision being done in 11 and a half months versus the 12-month requirement that the previous rules had. And then we also had questions related to the role of the individual who was attesting to the experience because they were unable to reach the supervisor. So it was a custodian of records that attested to the experience, was also a certified and licensed behavior analyst. But it did raise, you know, some concerns about how generic that role was. And so, again, we wanted to get the actual official documentation that was sent to the BACB, which has been provided to us in time. So I think at this time, I would move that we accept the application.
We have a motion to accept. Is there a second?
I will second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Like sign. Motion carries. Application is accepted. Thank you very much. I will stall for a little bit more.
Can I stall with a question to the Attorney General?
Yes.
So in the document reads for us, and again, if you want to look at that current case, you can. It talks about the idea of who can sign based on their experience. And so this is a general question about that application.
Okay, thank you.
What latitude is there for a term that simply reads that they're knowledgeable of someone's experience? That seems to be not very well operationally defined. Like, what is knowledgeable? Well, I know they were here. Their HR records show that they were present. Is there any sort of information you can provide that might help the Behavior Analysts Committee moving forward as they receive this attest from someone who, you know, in this case, this person was a BCBA. They're bound by Connecticut or Kentucky licensure. They're bound by national certification. But what if it had been an administrative staff that had signed that? That may have given us even more pause.
So that's actually a legal question that I would have to answer in executive session.
Oh, wow.
So we can go into executive session for legal advice if you want, or, you know, maybe during a break I can consult with you at that point.
Yeah, maybe during break is fine. I don't want to go into it. This is just and again, this is language that has recently been changed on the application. So I think the committee is just looking for some information.
Okay.
Dr. Davis Wilson and I can convey that back to them. Thank you.
Recusing from number 14, so Dr. Flower is taking over as chair.
All right.
Yes. I guess a lot of you have seen the documentation that we received, a recommendation from Dr. Olvey in regards to Dr. Bohansky becoming a fellow of the ASPB. He's an outstanding candidate for that position and honor. There are a number of things he's done. I didn't fully understand all of them. He does an outstanding job as chair of this board. And from what I gather, this is his third time he has experienced. And things that he's done include on the board here for 10 years, 2014, 2017, and currently. And during the time that he has been here, due to his efforts and that of the board, many positive things have happened. Examples include forming the telepractice committee, establishing rules for telepractice, gaining legislative approval to become the first state to adopt CIPAC, establishing an optional temporary license for individuals completing postdoctoral experience, as well as planning and promoting the board's 50th anniversary, including hosting the ASPB annual meeting in 2015 in Tempe. He's not only that, done a lot with the ASPB committees and task forces, including implementation of Task Force 2016 to present, which has been responsible for development and oversight of the ECCC Step 2 Competency Task Force, mid-year meeting planning, annual meeting committee, and learning objectives and meeting procedures for committee. He's also attended and been a speaker at numerous ASPB mid-year and annual meetings over the past 10 years. I remember back in 2015, when I was very new to the board, we had the ASPBB meeting here in Tempe, and lo and behold, I see Dr. Bohansky on the stage making a presentation, which was outstanding. This guy has done some stuff. I learned a lot. His work to promote licensure goes well beyond the service on the board. He established in 2001 a training program for pre-internship, internship, and postdoc supervision at the Southwest Behavioral and Health Services, one of the largest community-based behavioral health providers in the state. The internship program has been APIC member since 2006. In 2015, the internship program was awarded accreditation by the APA Commission on Accreditation. The program has trained over 100 individuals since inception and helped address the critical shortage of internship and postdoc sites available for psychology trainees in Arizona and in the Southwest. In addition, he's established a training institute through Southwest Behavioral and Health Services, which is approved by the American Psychological Association to sponsor continuing ed for psychologists. It offers early bird and bi-monthly Two for Tuesday CE programs with topics of interest for psychologists at no charge. He is clearly uniquely qualified for ASPB fellow status. The ASPB awards fellow status to a maximum of 3 individuals a year, which makes this very competitive. And I really feel strongly that the board should put forth a strong recommendation with some of these or all of these topics and highlights of his career, with a strong recommendation from us that he be approved and appointed.
I fully agree. Do we need a motion?
If I could just have a motion that I may draft a letter of support and probably under my signature, Dr. Flowers, if I have the timing correct, submit that in support of his nomination.
I'll make that recommendation.
I'll second that recommendation.
I guess I don't know if we call the question or not, but all approve, say aye.
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 Aye. Any nays? Okay, sounds good.
He's a worthy candidate.
Yeah.
I hope the letter will also convey his sense of humor and humility that he has, given just the list and the litany of things he's done in his career.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's
important, too.
Yeah.
Just genuinely nice person.
And loves dogs.
And loves dogs.
Exactly. We can include that, too.
Yeah, we're talking about you.
Yes.
Most of it was good. I'm sure Dr. Wexler will fill you in on the comments later. Now that I see him there, maybe we should have tamed that down.
Maybe do a little bit more.
Yeah. It comes to mind as slacker, right? I'm really just unengaged.
You let him talk? I set later. That as a precondition. Have we heard from...
Okay,
then not to hold people over, since the majority of these folks are interested in number 15. What I'd like to do, our timed items are managed. If we can discuss this before lunch, then I'd like to get through that. And I have more people who would like to talk. Item 15 is a discussion, consideration, possible action regarding the closure of the Arizona School of Professional Psychology, Argosy University, and how statutory requirements may impact or limit potential future applicants. We have a number of people who have chosen to speak. Dr. Wexler, would you like to begin and give us a good orientation and overview, and then I will call on others if they still want to speak after listening to you.
It's dangerous giving me the microphone, Dr.
Well, I'm more used to you sitting next to me so I can punch you. But.
Well, good morning, and distinguished board members. Nice to be here. Never really pictured myself sitting at this table, but here I am. I'm really here to talk about what's happened to the Argosy students and the potential impact that has not only on the students, but our state. So I'm going to provide a very brief review. I'll try to keep my personal feelings about the evolution of this matter restricted. In January, the faculty and staff of Argosy University were informed that the university was going into receivership. The receiver that was appointed by the court had a consulting relationship with the parent corporation, Dream Center Education Holding, for 6 months prior to his being appointed as receiver, and was well aware of the financial situation facing the university and the parent company. Shortly after being appointed as receiver, it was discovered that over $13 million in student federal loan monies that was due the students was somehow misappropriated. It was used for other things, and a full accounting of what it was used for and what happened to the money has never been forthcoming. There are insinuations that it was used for payroll and other university expenses. However, even though supposedly a forensic accountant was hired to find out what happened to this money, that question has never fully been addressed. It's suspected that there was some not only misappropriation but potentially criminal activity that involved in the mismanagement of those funds. But the impact on the students has been profound. At the time, students were getting eviction notices because they couldn't pay their rent. The students were having difficulties paying for groceries, and faculty, who never received their last paycheck, by the way, were buying Safeway gift cards so students could buy gasoline to travel to their practicum sites and continue to provide the over 2,000 hours a week of community service that they were doing on practicum, and also buy groceries. There was very much a lack of transparency in this whole thing that ultimately ended up with the receiver deciding to close the university without permission of the court that appointed him, and students were virtually given 2 days' notice in the middle of a semester, and there was no plan to teach out the remainder of the program, or no plan to even teach out the rest of the semester. This put students in a real bind, obviously. They would be lacking credits, and the negotiations to try to find a university to teach out the program was hampered by the fact that there was no other professional school in our state that offered a PsyD that was willing to do it. The Chicago school stepped up to the plate and offered to look at our curriculum and our coursework and to create a walkover to their programs. But the problem with that is you have students who are getting evicted. They can't pay groceries for their groceries, and they can't buy gasoline, and now they have to relocate to one of three cities where the Chicago school offered APA-accredited programs. Students don't want to go to a non-accredited program. So they could move to Los Angeles, they could move to Chicago, or they could move to Washington, D.C. The relocation expenses and the uprooting of their families is prohibitive. Living in Los Angeles, Chicago, and Washington, D.C., is largely more expensive than living in Arizona and Phoenix, even though we have better weather. Students transferring might not get all the credits that they had already earned in their doctoral programs. There were 145 approximately clinical psychology students that have been impacted by this, and there are a large number of school psychology doctoral students that are being impacted by this. And if you go on Indeed.com and look for jobs as a psychologist, you'll see that there's a huge shortage of school psychologists in our state. So there's an additional problem in that there are currently 41 Arizona students in clinical psychology, and I'm not aware of the number in school psychology that are either on internship and are going to graduate this August, or are headed to internship and will graduate a year from August. They have completed 98 credits, or close to 98 credits, in residence at the Arizona School of Professional Psychology. I found out recently that not all of their credits are transferring, from all the students, are transferring to these other universities that have accepted them. Case in point, one student who had 26 credit hours left to take before he would go on internship was informed that if he transferred, he would have to take a total of 52 hours. So the expenses and the economic impact has been huge. The 41 students that from our program, the clinical program, that will either complete their internship in August or will start their internships in August will not be eligible for licensure in our state because of Statute 32-2071-K3, which requires 18 credits in residence at the university they graduate from. I've had discussions with the Chicago School of professional psychology in terms of their willingness to somehow verify or validate the residency that these students have all met. And the impact actually goes beyond these 41 students because there are 9 other clinical psychology programs, many of whom were larger than our program, that have fourth and fifth year students that will be graduating either this August or the following August, who will no longer be eligible for licensure in the state of Arizona. The number probably exceeds 500 potential psychologists for our state. So I want you to think of the impact not only for the 41 students in the clinical psych program and possibly another 40 students in the PsyD program for school psychology, but there are a large number of potential licensees that will no longer consider employment in our state as a result of this statute. As I said, the university is not going to put anything on their transcript, the Chicago School, that would validate a residency because they basically can't do that. That would be disingenuous on their part. It seems to me that the only option left, because you can't just ignore the statute, the only option left is to change 322071K3. To modify it somehow so these students and the potential cascade of licensees across the nation who might consider employment in Arizona would become license eligible. You have people who are going to want to apply for licensure this August. You have people, a large number of people who are going to want to apply for licensure the following August. Some of the students that will finish their degrees have not yet decided to transfer yet. It's highly problematic. So I'm here really to advocate that you change the law because I don't see that there's any other remedy available for these students. And if you think about the impact that they've already incurred, probably over $200,000 worth of student loan debt, which is going to be a number that's going to grow substantially forced by their relocation, the fact that these students have to take out higher interest loans, the impact to them is devastating. And I don't think that this 18 credit residency requirement should be another burden to students who've already suffered tremendously. I'm not sure that requiring 18 credits in residence at the university that they graduate from actually protects the public, particularly when it's an APA-accredited program that they'll all be completing. So those are my comments. I'm happy to answer any questions you have. Obviously, being the former dean of the program and having built the program since its infancy, I have a lot of strong feelings about everything that's transpired, but I'm really advocating that the board do the right thing for these students and change the law. Thank you.
Are there questions for Dr. Wexler?
So Dr. Wexler, good to see you. Heartbreaking. I mean, the whole situation is just heartbreaking, and I feel for the students. That's for sure. I mean, I couldn't even imagine being at that place at that time, thinking, you know, you got 2 days for shutting the door. So, looking at the statute, do you have a recommendation of what you're suggesting that we remove the part about it has to be with an institution? Because it's a pretty detailed section.
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly one thing that could be done. You need to carefully evaluate, following Dr. Bohansky's wise counsel earlier about setting precedents in terms of if you were to change that particular thing, and it would allow these students to get licensed would it somehow jeopardize the welfare of the public, you know, allowing other people who are not qualified to get licensed in? I frankly, at this point, don't see how it would do that. Mm-hmm. That would certainly be one of the only options I could see in terms of changing the law.
So the point of this, and I represent the public, so the students know. So, and I loved your comment at the end because I do respect you. We've been on this council before, and you know, because my concern is the public. So the intent of this, I believe, is that then at least those hours were under the umbrella of an institution. I guess the purpose of that to ensure that it's a good internship, that where their working's appropriate. Why? What do you think the benefit of that was?
Well, for these particular students, the education was under the auspices of an institution. Internships are another matter. All Argosy students, clinical students, are required to participate in the national match for internship, and the school does not recognize internships that are not APA accredited or APIC member. So the internship is a little bit separate from the university issue here. I think Dr. Bohansky could probably address this better, that the 18 credits in from the institution that awarded the degree was to prevent people from jumping from program to program and getting a doctoral degree and then having the having either their bad karma follow them even though they got the doctoral degree, or making sure that the program was truly met the criteria of being a program in applied psychology.
There was a concern about the proliferation of online schools.
Online schools, yeah.
That
and yet,
as we had one here earlier
right,
today,
and yet there are online schools that have found a way around the residency requirement.
Correct, which is why that one was so worded in such a wacky way.
Yeah.
It was to stop the people from getting around it and making them eligible for licensure here, even though they hadn't gone through all of what your students have gone through,
right,
or what we think of as doing it the right way, what all our university, major universities do.
Yeah. But today you have Capella University, which does a lot of online education. You have Walden University, which does a lot of online courses. You have Union Institute, which is also entirely online. And they have found ways around this residency requirement to enable them to get licensed in our state. The other thing is, I think too, that you know, you reach a point where you have to evaluate if a law is serving the purpose or a statute is serving the purpose of protecting the public. And I'm not sure that this particular aspect of the statute does anymore. And the last thing I'll say, it may sound a little moralistic, and please forgive me for that, but there's just no right way to do the wrong thing. And making it more difficult for these students is just not the right thing to do.
You mentioned that there's some graduating in August. Is Argosy giving out certificates?
No,
Argosy University
does not exist anymore.
So these
students will have to graduate from another graduate program that they've transferred to. That's
the crux of the problem, is all their residency time was at Argosy.
Right.
Now in the midst of an internship in which they're not taking any more classes because they finished them, they're not doing a dissertation or CPRP because they finished it,
right,
they're struggling to finish their internship. And when they're done, they fully expected and paid for and worked through, they're expecting a degree. And now the place to hand out the degree is no longer there. So they now have to formally transfer into another university.
Right.
and get a degree granted by that other university under an articulation agreement that allows them to make such a move. But the issuing university, they've done no coursework at. And our law requires they do at least 18 hours there.
Right.
The articulation agreement, and Dr. Wexler knows I've been in as much heated negotiation with the university, the Chicago school, as anyone. The articulation agreement clearly states they're waiving the residency requirement because they have a similar residency requirement. Our recommendation was that they verify the residency having been accomplished in that articulation agreement, which then would have allowed them to note it on their transcript, which then would have allowed us to accept it. Mm-hmm. And we've been battling with their legal counsel for some time, and they're saying, no, that would be a falsehood, even though we all know damn well that the students never took a damn class there. And so it's almost standing on a stupid principle. But these students, and I have several.